I recently became homeless about 10 years ago.
So when I lost my job, I lost the roof over my head. That's been a couple months ago.
So for me, man, like, this has been a struggle for me.
I'm a brick mason by trade. That's what brought me here to Charlotte.
You know, you have no purpose, you have no identity.
I'm a certified building maintenance service tech. Electrical, plumbing, carpentry, all that. I'm certified in that.
I've been homeless for the last past 7.5 years.
I don't want my family to see this. They know I'm homeless, they don't know what that entails.
I don't wish this on anybody.
I want to be off the streets.
I'll do anything, man, to get off the streets.
I'm sitting here right now looking up the definition of creativity. I know, but bear with me. Here we go. Creativity. The tendency to generate or recognize ideas, alternatives, or possibilities that may be useful in solving problems, communicating with others, and entertaining ourselves and others. Here's another one. Having or showing an ability to make new things or think new ideas. Using the ability to make or think of new things, involving the process by which new ideas, stories, etc. are created. That seems pretty appropriate to what we're doing today. This may be shocking news to some people, but I believe everyone has a creative side. Right? Can you believe it? Everyone. No matter your background or where you come from, everyone has a creative side. I think there is some who have a harder time accessing theirs or believing that they have it, but it's there. Tell a story, play an instrument, knit a scarf, develop a new app that will tell me when I've left my keys in the lock on the outside of my door 100 million times. Everyone has a creative side. Even those people you walk past who call the streets their homes. Today, I talk with two longtime friends, Steve Umberger and Jay Thomas, who were part of an arts program that turned into a documentary film that illustrates that very thing. This is a conversation with three guys who come from creative backgrounds and professions and are using those skills that we have to try and help share stories from the homeless community or housing challenged, and maybe through their stories create a different perspective on who they are and how best to try and support them. Thanks for showing up. This is You May Have Seen. Here we go. First of all, I'm talking to my good friends, Steve Umberger and Jay Thomas. Thanks so much for being here, guys. I appreciate it. Steve is a longtime theater director, incredibly talented. We've worked together a handful of times over
numerous
the years.
Numerous times.
Numerous times. We've known each other for 100 years.
By this point, you know, you just say numerous times.
Numerous times.
That covers it.
Yeah, because you've worked all over the place, right? We'll get to that. Jay Thomas, another good friend. We were neighbors, Jay. We lived across the street
from
each other.
I forgot about that.
Way back in the old days.
A lot of actors came to the Cat House.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And you were the guy watching the show from across the street.
Mm-hmm.
You creepy, creepy bastard.
You lived across the street from the Cat House?
I still have the house there.
You do?
Yeah, that's the house I got out of college and then ended up buying it and had a tenant there for 17 years now. So
I did not know that.
Yeah, man.
Got to come to Brian LaFontaine to find out.
That's how I met all the actors, that and being in the film business, you know. People would come over there and I was like, oh, I've seen you on set or whatever. And so it just kind of worked out.
So you were there when Graham and Audrey
yep.
lived there and uh-huh. everybody yeah, yeah, yeah. has gone
that's,
through.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's how I knew Graham and Audrey was from that.
So here we go. Answer it however you want. Steve Umberger, Jay Thomas, where may we have seen you? Hold for laughter.
Well, I cover the waterfront, so, you know, it could be any old place. Could be in a theater lobby. It could be in a rehearsal hall. Could be on a TV interview.
Right.
Any of those things.
Any of those things.
Any number of things.
Yes. Jay Thomas.
Probably haven't seen me because I'm usually behind the scenes most often.
Right.
Television editing being the first thing. I've edited hundreds of TV shows from Discovery Channel to some sports and racing and whatnot to other things that are on Amazon and so on and so forth. And then my late wife got me into theater, which is how I met Steve, probably 17 years ago when Paige, my late wife, was in Midsummer Night's Dream I think, at Cape Fear.
Yeah.
And we had just started dating, and that's, I came down to see her, yeah. and I met Steve like around the same time Paige and I got together. So
I met Jay, first of all, through Paige's phone that she would finish every night. She would finish rehearsal.
Yeah.
And she would listen, you know, fully and completely and faithfully to all the notes, and she'd be fully engaged. But as soon as she had nothing else to do, she had her coat on, she had her earpiece in, she was leaving the theater, and she was talking to Jay Thomas.
Oh, my gosh.
Come to find out.
Mm-hmm.
This
oh
is
my
what,
gosh.
What was going on. Yep. So I was sort of in on the beginning of it all.
So anyway, Paige got me into theater. So I went from kind of film, TV into the visual projection design and things like that.
Right.
That is now so prevalent in theater. Before, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't as prevalent. Which is also how I have ended up working with Steve and doing some theater projects with him, some projection design with him, and then now into some documentary work, which right. is kind of why we're here.
Exactly. I've been looking forward to this interview because I get to cross over, you know, the entertainment side of my life and background and career with what I've been dealing and talking about in the past several months, which is the homeless situation here in Charlotte. And then come to find out, you guys had been putting together this documentary called
Street Smart.
Call Me By My Name. Yes, a documentary film.
The program that was created is called Street Smarts.
Right.
And out of Street Smarts
right.
came Call Me By My Name, which is the name of the documentary itself.
Yes. And with the emphasis being on the arts part of Street Smarts.
Yeah.
In connection with... Yeah. With your production company and First United Methodist Church here in Charlotte. Talk about this whole experience. I mean, I can't
How
believe
did it happen?
I
was thinking about that this morning. I was trying to remember exactly when it did start, and I went back through 600 plus emails that I have exchanged with Val Rosenquist, who is the senior pastor of First United Methodist Church, which has a long, long history of serving the unhoused community. You know, we found out nobody in this project likes the word homeless. Val became the pastor at FUMC, I can't remember how many years ago, but the homeless service started before she came, and then she has really worked to help grow it. And on Sunday mornings, they started something that they call Muffin Ministry. That started because there were a lot of unhoused neighbors without homes
right.
downtown. And they had a coffee pot
right.
and they had a basement room. So out of fellowship, they decided to invite those people in for a cup of coffee. And it has grown to now every Sunday morning they serve between 150 and 250
wow.
Homeless
yeah.
people.
Right.
And restaurants donate food. There are tables and tables of food, and it's a really extraordinary way of seeing what that community is, or one
right.
piece of
right.
what that community
right.
is. And so, I knew Val because I had been to the church. We had actually rehearsed a play there that Jay also worked on, right. called The Christians.
Yes,
and she said to me, we had coffee one day, and she said, I want to do an arts program for the homeless community. And I said, oh, you should do a theater project. And sort of the rest is history. We began to talk about how theater would be represented in that program. And that program, she named it, this great name, Street Smarts.
Yeah. Yes.
So you were saying about Street Smarts again, how it was titled? Just because I'm an editor, I know he's going to need that again. So.
Every time Street Smarts is mentioned, we're going to hear that sound.
It keeps
There's
it real.
Something about
it keeps
that.
It real. It keeps us grounded.
That's right.
Yeah.
The original incarnation of it had pottery, and it had beadwork, and it had various poetry, various things. Mm-hmm. And the theater aspect of it, you know, I thought about, well, an acting class for the homeless community. What's the framework for that?
Sure.
Where's the precedent for that? But then pretty quickly I thought it would be really, really interesting to have a theater class, an acting class, quote unquote, that might have some of the basics right. of that for those who were interested. But it would be really interesting to me for them to tell their own stories.
For sure.
It was a question of how do you do that? I mean, there really is no framework for that.
Exactly.
At all. And so I went down to Muffin Ministry a couple mornings. All of us who were involved in the program mm-hmm. went there with our mics in hand with these people who had really just come to have, you know, sandwiches and sausage biscuits yeah. and eggs and all of that. And we worked the crowd, so to speak. You know, we stood up and said, here's what we want to do. And I said, you know, I want to hear your stories. About a month later, we began the program. Mm-hmm. And at the very first, there were two people there. For about a month, right. there were two people in it. And then gradually, over time, as the word filtered through, we had a lot of people, actually, who came through the program, many of whom couldn't stay.
Yeah.
Health reasons sure. or reasons of commitment or transportation. Or there's such complication in the lives of the people in that world. But right. eventually, we developed over about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months,
right.
a group that became the core group
yeah.
that was six people that represented so many different aspects
yes.
of the homeless community. Just like the regular community, no two alike. There are no two alike, and that is one of the reasons I was interested in doing the project.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons that they remained committed to doing the project. To dispel the stereotypes, the generalizations that the homeless people are who you think they are when right. you pass them on the street.
Right.
If you even see them,
that, oh, yeah.
You know, that they're much more talented, mm-hmm. they're much more creative, resourceful. I think that's the thing that I really found out. These are tough, tough people, resilient. And they're smart. They are street smart. So the program grew. We first started talking about it in 2017, late 2017. In 2018, it started, it built. Mm-hmm. And then along the way, we would do presentations. The workshop was composed of group discussions,
yeah.
some of which were recorded and transcribed.
Mm-hmm.
I would give them assignments. There was homework. I mean, this really was work for them. And they would bring in the assignments, they would read them, and gradually they became more forthcoming
yeah.
with their personal lives. You know, a lot of times they don't want to do that. They want to fly under the radar.
Sure.
And they're also experiencing a lot of pain and isolation, of course. And there's mental illness. You know, in that community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough go. You know, it's a long arc for them to lose the edge that they have on the street and pull up around the table and realize that they are in a safe place and they can talk and they can spill the beans,
right.
so to speak.
Now, had either of you had any experience or connection to the homeless community prior to this project?
None at all. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do it.
Yeah. I like how you say in the documentary that you wanted to confront the homeless situation. You actually say that it was something that
do
you
I
wanted to
that?
Confront. And I love that you phrase it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, and I wanted to do that with myself too, because, you know, we all say, oh, it's a terrible thing. Oh, you know, we wish, you know, we sympathize with it. But when you get right down to it, what really are we doing about it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, the first thing to do is to find out what it is. And I won't pretend that this is a definitive description of the homeless community.
Right.
There are people who have said, who have seen the presentations and seen the documentary, who have said to me, are they really representative of the homeless community? You know, and they're referring
right.
to the creativity
mm-hmm.
and they're referring to the intelligence that they're seeing, which speaks right to the issue of the preconceptions.
Right.
And my answer is, well, they are members of the homeless community. So to that extent, yes, they
yeah,
are.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of people who didn't come and join the program.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know, so.
Yeah. And there
and
are a lot
of people that did and dropped out because they weren't comfortable also, right?
They weren't comfortable and they weren't, yeah, some weren't comfortable, some weren't capable.
Yeah.
Literally, they weren't capable. There were two people, Shay and Buddy, who were in there. I think you, I'm not sure you ever filmed.
I didn't
them.
Meet them, but I know who you refer to in the photos of the
stills of them are in the documentary.
Yeah.
And they have since lived a documentary all their own. They have so many health problems. There's so many ups and downs. It's just an incredibly tough road.
Right.
And that was just beginning when they joined the group. So they were only in it for maybe a month. Yeah. And then they just couldn't continue. After the first year, we didn't know in the beginning this would be such a long. It is ongoing. I mean, even now,
yeah,
we're not meeting. That went away in the pandemic, like mm-hmm. so many other things. But we're continuing with screenings of this documentary. Mm-hmm. And up until the pandemic, we were still meeting. And I actually met with them on Zoom.
Yeah, I saw that.
Got them all on Zoom. It was mm-hmm. great. So it was 2.5 years mm-hmm. of building this. And once we got to a certain point, about maybe 6 or 8 months in, and they were fully, fully committed.
Yep.
And they really wanted to explain what it was like on the streets. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, this would be really great as a documentary. It was intended as a stage piece.
Right.
And we did it on stage.
Yep.
But at some point I thought I would really like to see where they live and
certainly.
How they live. And I asked them, and they were a little tentative at first, but by that time they realized that would explain better than words
yeah.
some of the things they were talking about.
Of course.
So that's when I called Jay Thomas.
Yep.
And I said, will you do this? He said, maybe.
I mean, was this something that you had ever, because this isn't your first documentary that you've worked on, like you said. So
no,
is this ever
a subject
that you explored before?
Yes. My only past dealings with the housing challenge, or homeless, as people say, was probably just a random person that I might give something. I do remember back when I worked for Silver Hammer, we had a particular man that would kind of come around and I kind of got to know mm-hmm. a little bit of his past, but that's pretty much the extent of it.
Yeah.
And really, I enjoy working with Steve, so I kind of just blindly follow him wherever he asked me to go.
Right.
On the first day, you remember you said, we're headed out the door to follow the first person we were filming. You looked at me and said, is it safe?
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I at first I was a little apprehensive about going to where they lived.
Sure.
I mean, I'm a big guy, but I don't like confrontations. Mm-hmm. And there was, some apprehension and some fear and some...
Absolutely.
Well, and it is not unjustified because actually...
Correct.
That person that mm-hmm. I'm referring to was Scott Anderson. He was the first one that we filmed.
Right.
And Scott, and going to his campsite. And ultimately, as you find out in the documentary, Scott was killed. We believe at that campsite. Mm-hmm. So that's a logical
truth.
Thing.
Yeah, there's truth into that. And then the other thing was I have some past dealings with some mental health in my family as a young kid that mm-hmm. really made a mark on me and kind of terrified me.
Right.
And so I also know that that's a component of the housing challenge is mental health. So I was a little afraid.
Sure.
Honestly, not just scared, but also afraid about meeting and associating with these folks.
So then how did that change for you then as this progressed? I mean, because you were, again, the reason why I wanted you to be a part of this conversation is because to me, you were like this bystander watching it all mm-hmm. happen. You didn't, you're the guy behind the camera. You're the guy holding the camera. You're recording everything, but you're the one truly, you're like that eyeball that watches and sees mm-hmm. and captures. And then you get to go and sift through and edit and watch these things over and over and over as you put the story together.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really interested on how that whole experience and, what that did to your perspective.
Well, I think much like the classroom, as they continued to meet, a certain amount of safety came into play. That put my mind at ease knowing that Steve and the group had been meeting. Steve had knew these people. I didn't feel like he was going to just drag me into some unknown that
right.
immediately I was kind of comforted, like, yeah, we're going to be fine.
Sure.
We didn't have security or anything, but I still asked, after that first, because we're going in these, behind hidden places and mm-hmm. you don't know that there might be other people there that you know, might be out to get whatever. I mean, yeah. it's
well, and you know, one of the things that happens that we had spent, I had spent with the group a year building, is the reason that it can build is because they get the message that we are there
yeah.
to listen.
Right.
We're not there to exploit. We're right. not. We're there to listen. Christina, who's in the documentary during one session, she said this great thing that she ended it with, "This is better than therapy."
I have no doubt.
You know, because they yep. really, the trust is well placed. So that was pretty well the truth when Jay came into the project. So the vibe is safer than it yeah. might be.
And I know that that takes a while to cultivate, for sure. I mean, I'm sure yeah. that they were very apprehensive at first.
Yeah. Yeah. Hilda, who is another one of the ones you see in the documentary, said, you know, I thought a long time before I actually agreed mm-hmm. to show you where I live
and right.
show you my life. But they, like she said, like they all said, this will show you. This will be useful.
Right.
Or we hope this will be useful to really tell people what it looks like
yeah.
from the ground.
The documentary was fantastic. I know I told you both this. I watched it twice and it affected me emotionally both times. You know, I know I saw two slightly different versions of the film as it progressed along through the editing process, but I mean, I thought it was really, really fantastic and really, it hit me so hard.
Let me just ask you a question.
Yes.
I know that you're asking the questions here.
Go ahead.
Let me comment on this for just a minute.
Do it.
What did you learn from it? I mean, what was your experience with it? What was new about what you were watching? Did you...
It was, I think it was, well, again, like you said earlier, no two were alike. And I know that I've got minimal experience so far in having direct interactions, one-on-one interactions with people from the homeless community. So I haven't had the opportunity to truly experience more of the different stories and the yeah. different personalities. Yeah. And it was affirming in a lot of ways because I know that there are more to these people than what most people think at first glance. And the documentary absolutely illustrates that in so many different ways, not just from the artistic and creative side, but just on the human mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something that, I mean, I took notes as I watched the film, things that just really stuck with me. At the end of the documentary where Paul,
yeah, yeah.
Where he talks about... the quote from his grandmother about the yes. three sides to the
yes.
coin.
Yes.
I was like, that is fantastic. Yeah, that is just so fantastic. And how spot on is that? That there yeah. are three sides to the coin. There's heads, there's tails, and there's the edge. And you better be on that edge or else you're not going to be able to see both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and most people really, what it confirmed is, you know, most people, and this is understandable, people like to see in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, people like to yep. sort of know, okay, that's the good side, that's the bad side. Makes it easier in life if it's all very clear.
Right.
And not shades of gray, but this is nothing but shades of gray.
Yeah.
And it's confusing to people. But I think the first thing, I think what I've learned is the first thing is that you have to acknowledge. You just have to look and listen. For a while,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have to spend time and pay attention to it enough. You have to get close enough to it
yes.
to really understand how complex it is.
Right.
And then you're going to make different choices. Because right now what happens is that people make choices that they think, from an uninformed standpoint, oh, I'll take food. I'll deliver food.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'll leave a pile of winter coats
right
on this bench.
Right.
Those are the last things. Those are the last things that people need. Everybody who came through that program said, you would be amazed at the amount of food that we have access to on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, four or five meals a day.
I learned a lot about that type of stuff. And obviously, I wouldn't take a load of blankets, but those things you don't even think about, you know. That's, I might take one blanket, but yeah. how do I know that he doesn't have three other blankets stashed over here?
No.
I mean, you know, without questioning or asking.
I just want to say you mentioned the tent city.
Yeah.
Frankly, that was one of the things that happened with the tent city because it, you know, became a
right.
hygiene
right.
issue and it had to be cleared. But one of the reasons that happened is because there was so much food delivery.
Oh, exactly. Right.
You know, that couldn't be cleared. It couldn't be consumed mm-hmm. in a normal way. And right. so it accumulated. And
so as part of the takeaway from this, hey, Charlotte residents, thank you for being so supportive and wanting to help. But maybe let's figure out how to build a house instead of going grocery shopping. Is that the takeaway? Yeah. We need to go into carpentry?
Yes. And that's when people go, a little bit more than I thought.
I know how to go to the grocery store, but I don't know how to frame a bedroom.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there's something to that or not. I am guilty of that. I did, a few years ago, just on a whim, I got in the car and I drove to Chicago because I had never been before. And I was like, I'm going to go to Chicago. I'm going to get away for a few days. And it was early March, end of March, which is still pretty chilly up there.
Mm.
And, you know, the homeless situation in Chicago is pretty visible, at least when I was there. And what's that main? It's Michigan?
Oh, Michigan.
Yeah. Hotels. Yeah. So at night, like the sun's going down, homeless people are right around there. And there was a mom with her two kids, and it was just bitter, bitter cold. And it just was like arrow through the heart. And I did, and I went to the Rite Aid and I bought blankets and I got them those hand warmers that you hold in your hands and stuff like that and whatever. And I just came out and I was like, here you go. In hindsight, it was like, yeah, probably wasn't the most helpful thing, but maybe at least to get them through the night, you know.
Those things are all well intentioned in there, and there I think they are appreciated.
Yeah.
But the thing you learn, what I've learned at the depth of this experience, is that those are the small things.
Yeah.
You know, the big things are the things that are not people don't know, and so they're not paying attention to, so they're not happening.
Right. Right.
And you know, one example of something that happened with an audience member during the course of this, in one of the screenings mm-hmm. that we had at one of the libraries, this woman was visiting from New York, and she saw the documentary, and she liked it, and she was affected by it, and she decided to adopt, quote-unquote, one of the participants.
Really?
Yes. You know, she said, I'm a person of means, and I would like to help.
Wow.
And so she started a GoFundMe.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of doing all this, this is another example mm-hmm. of perspective. Her feeling was she was seeing enough intelligence, enough industriousness
mm-hmm.
in the person that she identified with, that she thought, well, this is a matter of money. This will be helped by my paying attention and helping financially.
Right.
For this person to get a job, get up, back up on their feet,
mm-hmm.
get a house, and move on with life. And it was in the course of all that that she realized how complicated it is.
Yeah.
And that's still in process. That mm-hmm. still hasn't been resolved.
Yeah.
Because I think the original intent was, okay, we'll do this for a year or two,
yeah.
help you, and then you'll be like us.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and then you also find out that there's not a desire always to be like us.
No.
That's another really interesting aspect.
So is there some kind of disconnect? I mean, that's the thing. You know, I don't think the documentary aims to solve as much as it aims to just put awareness out there.
Exactly.
And yeah. I don't have the answers either, but I guess I'm asking.
Mm-hmm.
There's a disconnect or something, right? I mean, you can give them everything, but there's a reason that they're there in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We'll be back with Steve and Jay in just a minute. We got to take a short break so I can promote this podcast and the wonderful network that we're a part of. This won't take long.
You May Have Seen is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Here's a little preview of the documentary Call Me By My Name, a film by Steve Umberger and Jay Thomas, and music by Fred Story.
So much going on out there that a lot of people don't know, and they should know.
If I was a writer writing a TV show, I could not make some of this stuff up.
I was interested in real stories, and I was interested in this community because I didn't know what it was.
I had an increasing interest in the homeless community.
We knew that there was some talent already, Not that I ever wanted to be a professional actress, but I want to understand what it's all about.
So the question became how to get these stories onto the stage.
I just talked about my divorce, my being married twice.
When I realized your questions were about my life, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know.
I had to learn to forgive. If I hadn't, I would be in the cuckoo house.
It's the first time I've ever seen anything like this.
See all those remnants? There's people still sleeping up there.
This was my corner. And everybody kind of knew it, and they would leave it alone.
I mean, this is where I stay on a nightly basis. This is where I'm here all the time.
It was like, are you going to put your stuff in storage? I'm like, why would I put it in storage? I don't have a place to live.
God, I wish it wasn't such a mess, you guys, but it's real life.
I'm not homeless because I believe I'm on my way to my home.
If it happened to me, it can happen to anyone.
When we began, I had budgeted money for actors to perform because I had no idea what this was going to be.
I guess Trump always lives upset.
Being in front of the stage, a live stage, and being able to tell my story, everything I've been through, it felt good. So I think this would just lend a whole different perspective as to life and what can be.
Now here's more with Stephen Jay.
I was hoping that we could uncover the common denominator.
Right.
That sort of mysterious X factor
right.
that you can't quite put your finger on. I said to them, at one point I said, what do you all need? This is maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 months in. I said, what do you all need? And they all said, we're good. We're good, we're fine. Clearly, they were not fine in the way we would say
right.
fine.
Right. Right.
But they were all really sort of very under it. You know, we're good, we're fine. And then later I said, if you could have the things that people have, if you could have the house and the cars and
right.
all that, would you, and it was not complicated, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Would you want it? Oh, yeah. Yes, we would. But all of them have learned, Mary, for example, is mm-hmm. someone who had a job mm-hmm. for a long, long time. She had a husband. She had a house in suburbia. She had 2 cars. She had the whole thing.
Yeah.
And learned through that that does not buy you happiness and says, I will never get into that kind of situation again.
Wow.
So in some ways, you're dealing with people who are street smart
mm-hmm.
about things that are unimportant that society makes important. And then that becomes the definition of how to succeed.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
There's, I do.
That's part of the disconnect. I have a very good friend and colleague, Lyndall Hare, is a gerontologist
mm-hmm.
From South Africa. She's worked with me on the other similar project that I've done, and she consulted on this in
right.
a key way, which I'll tell you about in just a minute. But she made the observation that they are, in a way, nomads. And she and Lyndall said, we used to make a place in the town square for the nomads, people who travel, they want to travel,
mm-hmm.
that's who they are, is life for them. We don't make a place for the nomads anymore. And it's an interesting
right.
idea to think about, right. okay, well, there's no category
right.
for the nomads,
yeah.
which the homeless community could be, it's a lot of things, but nomad could be part of that.
Absolutely. You're opening my eyes to a whole other element of that, of, you know, gosh, of just living minimalistically.
Yeah. Yes.
Truly.
Yeah. Yeah. The film Nomadland
mm-hmm.
Also talks mm-hmm. about that. You're tempted to say, well, they couldn't make it in society.
Right.
That's dangerous.
Yeah.
Because maybe they didn't want to make it in society. Does not mean that they're failures, doesn't mean that they just have different values.
Right.
And sometimes it's deemed as just freedom.
Yeah.
I've heard, or, you know,
yeah.
being stated in that way, of just
right.
being free.
So where is that line of differentiation between the efforts of, like, you know, the documentary, what I'm trying to do with the podcast, what so many other people and organizations in the city and around the country and around the world are trying to do to help those people who truly do not want to be in this situation, as opposed to the ones who are like, this is my existence. This is what I'm choosing.
I ask everybody who came through Street Smarts, you know, what do you need? What would help? What needs to happen? They all said, number one priority, affordable housing, affordable housing, affordable housing. Sometimes affordable housing is not affordable enough. And then they would say things like a community center where we can come and spend time, talk to people. One of them said a community pool. She said, I know that's not going to happen, but, you know,
right.
They talk about the same, the root of it is the same thing we would say, you know, a place to congregate, a place to share, a place to be with people. So you probably can look at it through the same lens and say, well, what would you want? What do you want in life? Well, there are some people who, A, can't afford those things, or B, don't want to afford those things, but they still have the same need. They still have the same capability.
Right.
So, you know, I just think it's an interesting idea to think that some of this could be helped by creating things that we're not aware of.
Right.
In that gap, in the nomad gap.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I've talked about this subject with a lot of people, and just even in general conversation with friends. And I have had some people say, oh, interesting that you're doing that. I mean, I get it, but you know, they can't stay here. They got to go somewhere. And that kind of hits me where it's like, wow, I don't know really what to do with that.
I mean, that's why you're doing it. That's why all of us are involved, I think, is just trying to figure out some kind of a solution or something.
Right.
I mean, it's not an easy problem.
Again, I really want to find out more about your experience of doing this whole documentary, because from both of you, I mean, how was it at the end of the day? Like when you were wrapped and done for the day and you had to go home with whatever stories you heard or people that you interacted with or just what you had seen or experienced, and how were you able to flip the switch and go, all right, I'm going to watch Netflix now or whatever. Yeah. How did you?
Yeah. It was tough in the very, very beginning when we would be in that basement room. And the first times I experienced the conversations and the private lives, you know, the really tough stories of their childhood and being on the street. And then we're finished and we're all at the elevator together. We're going to go in different floors and go different ways. And I'm going to my car and they're going out on the street. It was something. All of the people that I dealt with, that we all dealt with in it, They know themselves. They know their lives. None of them are young people. There are a lot of young people in the street. But the people that we dealt with in this project are all 40s, 50s, 60s. So they have a wisdom about it, and therefore a common sense. That there was no, there certainly was no, nobody ever said, okay, well, have a good time driving your car back to your house. And, you know what I mean? There was none of that. And again, I think it's because we all come at it with they become friends. They are friends. And all of our friends, you know, in real life, in anybody's life, have all different kinds of stories and situations and all that. And so that's the way it happened. There was never any discomfort about it, because I think there was always an interest in their lives, and they were interested in explaining their lives, and they understood that there was a receptive audience for it.
I can say that, I guess as an editor, I have a trait where I have to turn things off, almost probably like a healthcare worker or something. I remember a horror film that I worked on for months and months in a dark room by myself, and that one I couldn't really get away from. And I don't do that anymore. But, you know, I was having heart palpitations, all kinds of stuff. I'm like, what's going on? It's like, oh, maybe it's because I'm in this dark room editing all this content for hours and hours and days on a time. But this particular one, it was a little daunting, tough coming home after being at their locations, seeing how they lived, where they lived. But the hardest one was Scott, because, you know, we spent a good part of a day with him. you know, I end up spending days, multiple days staring at the footage. And, you know, as an editor, you kind of, you get to know people in a different weird way because you're watching them and hearing what they say again and again. And
yeah.
And I think it might have been the same day that I spent so much time editing Scott's piece that I got a text at like 2 a.m. from Steve saying that he was murdered. And we were just there. And I just spent all this time looking at his footage. And it just really, like, that was a tough one. And that really opened my eyes to really how vulnerable this community can be. And, right. and going back to what I said earlier, is this safe? You know, we were going to these places in the middle of the day where there's not usually a lot of activity and nobody was really around.
Right.
So it felt okay. It wasn't at midnight with people around. But after Scott was found murdered and then some of the writings that we had found, cause Val and Steve were able to go to the tent and clear out some of his writings and stuff, which we used in the documentary. But some of that was just really chilling.
Well, and there was in that, because Scott wrote, I say this in the documentary, he was already a poet. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just where his mind went because he'd had a very, very tough life. And I think it really helped him just to write things out. So he came to us already with that. And then I think he continued to grow within it and realize some things about himself as we were doing the project. So we knew that he had, Val actually really was intent
right.
on preserving whatever was at his campsite and got permission from the police. And we went out there and the place had been decimated. Nobody will ever know what the story really was. And found those writings. And among the pages was a page that he hand wrote on these notebook sheets of notebook paper. And it was all scrawled. But over top of it, in red, we don't know what the red, it could have been a crayon, could have been a lipstick, we don't know.
Yeah.
Were the words, "Please help." We don't know what that meant. It's easy to think that that was written
right.
at a critical time.
Mm-hmm.
That chilled me when I saw that. Just,
I bet.
Yeah.
And having been just, and obviously I didn't know him as well as you, I didn't spend as much time with him, but I could tell that he was a sweet soul with a lot to offer. And he was, right. I think, probably one of the more creative ones of the group from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. But he's an example also of somebody that you watch. I think you see this in the documentary and you think he's had such a tough run of luck, so to speak, that it's almost impossible to imagine him recovering from that. Right. He was 60 years old. And you see the effects that his life and his choices, I mean, he would say that, his own choices that he was trying to learn from, even at 60 years old.
Yeah.
It had gotten so tough for him mentally, emotionally, physically, that it was hard to see Scott. You think, okay, well, we're going to spend some time here, and the happy ending of this story is that you're going to emerge happier than ever, better than ever.
Right.
You will have had a metamorphosis and a, you know, transformation, and you'll just be great.
Right.
But you look at Scott and you really understand how tough it is to hope for that. That's not true of everybody in the documentary, but he's an example of, you know, one of those people. Physically, people would look at Scott, and we did hear this from other people who had known him, but not in the way that we had.
Right.
That it was alarming to them. They didn't know how to respond to him. And it's kind of a typical, one of those typical responses to homeless people that you don't know what to do, and so you avoid it. And you would never have gotten the chance to know. I mean, Scott had some violence in him. You know, he had some anger in him. But as we knew him around the table, he was total sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew he could be. That was the place where he could be, and he could sort of work the good side
right.
of himself. But just at a glance on the street corner, you know, a lot of people would avoid Scott.
Sure, sure. And I know that throughout the documentary experience, from start to finish, there were a couple of people who have since gotten off the street, according to what the documentary says. Was there any discussion or talk with them since then about what that challenge was like for them to get to that point where they're no longer homeless?
Again, no two alike. One of the people who has is Mary, the woman who I said had for years and years, she had a job, corporate job. She was a secretary. She had a 401k, all that. And her journey was slowly, being divorced and then an estrangement with other members of her family and then losing her 401k.
To try to help her family.
Right? Yeah, to try to help her family. And so she knew a life that had more security. In other words, she had come from something that she could sort of reference as she was guiding herself back in, unlike some of the other ones who never knew that kind of life. And so her journey back to being housed was much shorter than some would be. But the people who have become housed are terrified of being housed now for a couple reasons. The first one is that they think that the rising rents will make them homeless again. And that's a founded fear.
That's legitimate, yep.
It is. It is. And the other reason is a little more mysterious, maybe, and that's that they're not comfortable being cooped up,
Yeah.
And all that comes with it. I mean, that they talk about they need retraining in things like writing checks, maintaining bank accounts, living what we would call a normal life.
I did wonder if there is a sort of an institutionalization that, similar to prison, that comes along with, you know, being homeless and then no longer being homeless.
Right.
Like, oh, God, what do I do? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one of them said that when they had some money again, they were just terrified because they didn't know what to do. They thought they would lose it. You know, it had been such a slippery slope for them that they wanted some help, some guidance in a way that we at 50 or 60 or whatever probably would not need.
Right.
But I think that's a revelation to a lot of people. Oh, this could really be helped by having some situation where there's just assistance in how do I do these normal everyday things.
Right. I do know that there are some of the nonprofits out there that do have classes and workshops or programs that do assist with things like that. But I'm sure, it's not a universal thing that's available everywhere for sure.
Still need the affordable housing, which is what we were saying earlier, which is kind of a double-edged sword because people move to larger metropolitan center cities because there's more maybe programs or assistance for housing challenge, but then you're there where it's the most expensive place to live. So it's kind of like, how does that, it's almost like you should go in the middle of nowhere where you can afford, but then you don't have any programs or assistance. So it's, there's no city in America where you can earn minimum wage.
There's no state in the United States where a person working full time at minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom apartment at fair market rate.
There you go.
And that's, I was talking to Liz Clayson Kelly, who's the director of Roof Above.
Okay.
She had come to see the screening and was referencing that stat and said that, that's pretty much says.
That's the problem.
It.
Yeah.
Aside from how you got there.
Right.
That's another issue.
Right.
But once you're there, that's kind of a problem.
Yeah.
So we kind of find ourselves in a position where the projects that we've been working on and the things that we're involved in are to primarily educate as opposed to change because we're not in a position of power to be able to do that. So have you guys had any opportunity or exposure to be able to show the documentary or do the actual show for city, county, influential people?
Pat came to one, right? Didn't
Pat
she?
Cawthon.
Yeah, she
came to
city council,
and so did Mark Jarrell. It's an interesting timing. This everybody has a version of this story that the pandemic changed the track of something that was happening. But we had just gotten to the point where we had finished the documentary. We had done a performance at Spirit Square, mm-hmm. which was full. We did two presentations mm-hmm. of it. That was the first act was the documentary
yep.
being shown, then intermission. Then the second act was a live presentation by the participants
yep.
reading their script that yep. they had created. And we had just done that in the fall of 2019 as a little bit of a launch, we thought, we hoped, mm-hmm. to 2020.
Right.
Then we had, I think, 6 screenings scheduled in 2020. And we did the first one. We did the first three.
Okay.
That were in January and February. And the rest is history.
Right.
So, right. you know, that's the answer to that question.
But yeah.
I wanted to re-edit the documentary mm-hmm. and include some of the pandemic footage and also just make some changes. And then start again on that idea of trying to book. And we've just gotten a grant from the North Carolina Humanities Council
okay.
to do 10 screenings and wow. discussions. And we've done the first one.
Excellent. So what's the hope in the big picture? Or has there been any, has it changed since you started it? Now that the program is where it is and the yeah. situation in the community is the way that it is, has it changed or altered from when you started?
I would say to be announced.
Yeah.
Don't know enough to know that yet.
Right.
Originally, the goal was to do the program in perpetuity. It took 2 years.
Yeah.
Just for this group
right.
to grow. But that's great because it was its own information. And because the response to the documentary, a lot has been that it does break the conventional thinking. Mm-hmm. I think I got so early on that the value of it is going to be that. We're not going to use this to build affordable housing.
Right.
In other words, people are right. not going to leave this
right.
and go, let's build affordable housing.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I think the usefulness of it might be that people just stop. They just stop. Like Fred's story, who I have to really give
Love
a salute
Fred.
To, because Fred scored, you know, wrote mm-hmm. the music for this okay. documentary. And he's a real partner in this. And he said when he first watched it before he scored it, he said, well, it certainly changed my mind about a lot of things.
Wow.
Or mm-hmm. at least stopped me from thinking some of the things I've been thinking.
Yeah.
And that's a perfectly useful thing. So now that we have hopefully enough time and freedom to do these screenings, I'm interested in just gathering the comments.
Absolutely.
You know? So we'll have to do another podcast in another, you know, 10 months, and I'll give you the answer to that question.
Done. Deal. Because, I mean, obviously we'd be foolish to think that the people who are in power, who are working in, you know, in city council, government, or whatever, are not aware that there's a homeless problem,
sure,
that there's
yeah.
not a shortage of affordable housing. And I know, you know, in the idealistic Hollywood world, we would do something like this and it would change everything. So
this is just a little compassion and awareness is basically a little piece of it. That's all I think this can really be. And then maybe if you are a person in power that has to make a decision and you happen to see this, then that might spark a little bit in the back of your head going, oh, these are regular people that need some help.
I struggled with how to describe this.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And I think I've settled on saying it's a project and a film about the creativity of the homeless community. And that can mean artistic, but they are creating their lives. That's creativity in a big, broad mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. People who come thinking it's going to be a hard-hitting, I mean, I think it is hard-hitting in its way,
sure.
expecting something else based on their preconceptions about the homeless community.
Right.
I think it's not wrong to say it's about the creativity of the homeless community. And so hopefully when people see that, it reinterprets for them what the possibilities might be. And then you begin to think differently. So I won't take all of my leftovers
right.
and leave them on a bench. You know, I won't do this. I'll do something else. I don't right. know what it is, but I'll do something
right.
else.
Yeah.
You sort of have to know maybe what not to do before you know exactly what to do.
And that was actually going to be my next question, which was going to be, How has this changed you then? How has this experience changed you? And that's pretty much kind of what you summed up there.
I would say I was thinking about this earlier when Jay was talking. It's really hard to know how it has changed you. Ongoing. But I think what I would say is it's always on your mind. Once you have dealt this closely with these people mm-hmm. who are terrific people, and they become friends, and you know the circumstances, and you know more about the homeless community. Sort of every choice you make, everything you spend money on, everything you pay attention to, mm-hmm. you have that in the back of your mind. I don't know, at some point I might become aware of some big shift.
Right.
But I know that there are little shifts.
Yeah. Yeah, Colleen keeps telling me that when I, you know, when I wake up and I still have not solved the homeless problem,
yeah,
she talks about the ripples,
yeah.
the ripple effect of all the things.
I think about that too, because you never think you're doing enough,
right?
And you know what you're doing, and you know Steve bringing me into this. At least I'm involved to a small extent, a very yeah. small amount. I had something to do with something that might help.
Right.
And that's really, because you can't, it's too overwhelming to sit there and be like, how can we fix this? Because it's not that easy of a...
Right. And realistically, it's I don't think it's ever going to be fixed.
Right.
I think it can be improved greatly.
Yeah. But the ripples, that's what you're referring yes. to, basically, yes. right? I mean, just hopefully this goes out and
yeah.
and makes a wave, you know, and makes a small change somehow, somewhere.
Well, when you realize, historically, over the last 50-ish years... the things that have happened at a governmental level, what has developed,
mm-hmm.
and the way it's gone, that has stacked the deck against the homeless community.
Right.
And people, when it happens that incrementally, over generations, people don't see it. They don't understand. And so mm-hmm. then it becomes a matter of, well, these people are lazy. Mm-hmm. These people are mm-hmm. not pulling their weight.
Right.
Maybe sometimes it's that. Often,
sure.
often it is not that.
Right. I can't tell you, I mean, how many stories or even just in the small amount of interaction that I've had with people, you know, in all aspects of the community, the number of homeless people who actually are working and have jobs,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. who do go to work every day,
yeah.
I think would shock a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm left speechless by the product that you have created, the work of art that you have created, and the way you went about doing it. It's truly, truly wonderful. And I hope that it does, you know, create some ripples for sure.
Thank you for making a space for that to be talked about.
Some people help by donating money, goods, or their time. Others are out there on the ground, on the front lines, making a difference every day. Some of us are trying to help through storytelling, trying to show the humanity that some might be quick to dismiss when it comes to people who are in need, or quick to characterize or categorize people who don't have a home. I've been saying it since I started this podcast when I was interviewing actors who no one knew. Everyone has a story, and everyone's story is worth listening to. I want to thank Steve Umberger and Jay Thomas for doing the work and taking the time to get to know the amazing folks who are part of Street Smarts and the documentary Call Me By My Name. I hope you get a chance to find their program and see the film. You can find out more by going to playworksonline.org and clicking the Street Smarts tab. Thanks so much for listening. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout out in the next episode.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.